Good morning, I'm Werner Vogels. I'm a, as I say, I'm Werner, and I'm a recovering academic. Which basically means that if you know my history, about 3 years ago, after 15 years in academia, I left for Amazon. And so when Ellie gave me the invite for coming to talk here, I pondered for quite a while, thinking, you know, what is it that would make an interesting talk for the UX audience? Thinking about all the kind of different technologies we have at Amazon and blah, 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 and all these kind of things. And that probably that would have interested you, but given that UX always has been a sort of a middle ground between research and practitioners, I thought I was going to spend quite a bit of this time on actually my experiences from trying to take fresh research and push them into production in very large-scale systems. And so that's the kind of stuff that we do at Amazon. Now, actually, if you're a student and if you want some advice, the best advice you can give for me is buy one of these things, which is a remote control for your laptop for doing presentations. Yeah? The best $100, or you can get them for $40, that you'll ever invest. That is, if it works on the distance. Yes, it does. Okay, so I tend to drift away during presentations. And so there's a high probability that we will not get to the last slide, which will have the conclusions. So let me start off with this. So what do I think you should walk away with? Of course, at Amazon is a cool place to work and that we're hiring. That's probably the only plug that I'll do for Amazon throughout the whole talk. The rest is relatively generic. We'll have some details about, you know, what makes, what's the kind of scale that Amazon working at and things like that, but this is the only thing Amazon. That actually transitioning research into production is very hard. Much, much harder than I expected. Yeah, and I actually was kind of proud during my research days in thinking that I was actually developing technology that was really practical and that companies could just pick up and make work. After a number of years of trying to make this really work, I know how difficult it is. Yeah? The most important reason, in my eyes, why research fails to get adopted into production is because there are unrealistic assumptions made at the moment that you started doing your research. And we'll get into that, why I think those assumptions are unrealistic and what the causes of that and how we should help it. Yeah? And most of those assumptions actually have to deal with uncertainty. In real life, in really, really large systems, uncertainty plays a very important role. Even though we would like our systems to be really deterministic and know exactly what the input and the output is and what stages you have to go through, if you build really large systems, that is absolutely not the case. You cannot predict what's going to happen. Does that mean you cannot build software or you cannot build systems? Yes, of course you can. You just have to use different techniques. So if you're a distributed systems researcher, these words are very common to you. Actually, we like to believe that we invented them. Actually, this is not a list from a distributed systems textbook. This is a list from a biology textbook. These are techniques that your body and other components in nature use to gain robustness. And all these things like redundancy and feedback loops and loose coupling and all these things are at this moment at work in your body to keep you healthy. And one particular technique I would like to point out is apoptosis is a technique that your body uses to have about, what is it, 70 billion cells a day commit suicide just to keep you healthy. Now, 70 billion of your cells fail a day, voluntarily, but they fail, you function just as well. Yeah? So what you could see is that even under massive failure conditions, we can have perfectly working systems. So if biology can do it, maybe there's something to learn from that. So if we look at, you know, what are other really, really big scaling systems, we like to point to these kind of numbers. These are, you know, all the transistors we have these days on all the multi-cores. Cell phones are ubiquitous. If you look at credit cards, this is one of those worldwide distributed systems that just seem to work. I don't know how many credit cards there are. I think 4 billion is a kind of out-of-date number, but no matter where I am, in India or in China, there's many places where I can just use my credit card. And we seem to have a hard time getting internet and other things to work. Now, what is really scary is the number of rats in New York. 96 million. So we're getting to a larger number. And I don't know whether they included New Yorkers themselves in this, actually. But there's a case to be made for that. Sorry, Andy. So what is really large scale? Coming back to the more to the nature slash as a vision. If you look at number of neurons in your brain, 6.4 billion. Oh, no, the population. The neurons are about 100 billion. So, yeah, you can lose a few of those a day. And places like stars and galaxies, these numbers are really dwarfing us. So if we think about running stuff on 1,000 computers or tens of thousands of computers, they're nothing compared to other types of scale that just seem to work. And if you really want to think about, really scary stuff, the number of ants in this world are measured in quadrillions. Now, ants are actually a very interesting example because they tend to work without leaders. They are actually a very good example of a distributed system. If you see ants moving a leaf through your garden, you don't see a corporal ant walking next to it or a general that say, march, march, march. For some reason, these ants seem to figure out themselves how to collaborate and how to work together to move this leaf towards a goal. But, these are really, large scalable systems with redundancy and things like that. Now, often we tend to cite technology as one of the major reasons why things will scale. And these are some of those kind of things. Molecular circuits that are happening, being built, all the biometric stuff around security, all these things will make the world scale. In reality, I think there's many different drivers that will drive scale. And most of them will be social. It's not that Kazaa or BitTorrent or, say, any of these other very large distributed systems actually came to life because of technology. They played a role there, but it was there were social drivers there that really made these systems really big. And so I would like to believe that anything that has to do with sex, drugs, food, entertainment, immediately will drive you towards very large scale. So I actually have a proposal for a startup. It's called the Virtual Amsterdam Red Light District, which is a combination between nanotechnology, bioengineering, and a few other things that you'll walk up to a socket somewhere in the wall, you stick your finger in it, and you'll get an experience, let's put it like that. Somebody knows how to do this, come talk to me afterwards. But that will instantly require quite a bit of scalable infrastructure. Okay, I work for Amazon. So let's talk a little bit briefly about Amazon scale. We only have 7 websites. Remember that. We have about more than 60 million customers that are active on a yearly basis. I recently saw a different presentation actually from the MySpace guys who said, okay, so they had 110 million customers. If that would be a country, they would be number 19, I think, on the list of countries. So, of course, immediately I started looking up what Amazon would be, and we would be number 25 or something like that. So 63 million are a lot of customers, especially because they return almost on a daily basis. 101 million sellers. So Amazon is also a platform. You have people sell stuff on Amazon. It's not just that Amazon sells things there. There's about more than a million there. So these are other numbers of the size of our company. So important, I think that those sellers, about 1/3 of our sales, and about half, close to half of our sales comes out of international. So I don't know where the people consider Canada part of. Whether that's the international segment or not. I don't know. So Amazon over the past years, has gone through quite a bit of transitions. Yeah, and where Amazon started off as a retailer, pretty quickly started realizing that they had to become a technology provider to actually survive and to make it work. You know, there's one seller, now there's a million sellers. It used to be one app, which is just Amazon.com. Now it's a platform where not only, you know, Amazon sells them, but other people sell them, and actually we sell these services to the rest of the world. It used to be, especially in the first 5 years, I don't really know much about the history of Amazon, but this term that Jeff coined, saying get big fast, was also, the engineering motto, which meant that after 5 years, everything had to be redone. Yeah, because it absolutely had hit the maximum scalability that could be done. So it started off with just being website and databases. Now, Amazon is probably one of the largest distributed systems in the world. And all the things that you learn in your textbook about distributed systems are things that you learn in Amazon. Almost every possible software pattern, whether it's workflow, whether it's client-server, whether it's peer-to-peer, all of these patterns you'll find back in systems. Find web services, and most recently, all the web scale stuff, you know, how to provide very low-cost infrastructure services to whoever wants to use them. Different customers for Amazon. To give you an idea about, I want you to walk away also knowing that Amazon is more than just a bookshop. Yeah. Slight detail. So there's 6 different customers that actually use Amazon. Amazon is a technology platform where Amazon, the retailer, is just one of our customers. And actually, Amazon, the retailer, is what we call an enterprise customer, and we have many of those. Target, MBA, if you're from England, Marks & Spencer's, Mothercare, all of these very large websites should actually have a button that says powered by Amazon, but it's not. To these very large enterprise companies, we're selling enterprise services like identity, catalog, you know, fulfillment, all of these different kinds of pieces. Now, there's different. I actually fall into 3 or maybe even 4 of these categories. I'm a customer. Is there anybody that's not a customer of Amazon here? It's great to go to a place. Anybody have bad experiences with Amazon? Okay. Sorry about that. So I'm a retail customer. I'm an associate. I run a weblog, which I hardly ever update anymore. I apologize for that. But all the links that you'll find on there to books on Amazon actually have a little code in it. That means that I get 4 to 5% of it. If you link through that and go to Amazon. Actually, I thank all of you for clicking on those links because you give me about $20 a month. But there are other people that actually make. And then there's web service developers and the web scale. So this, just to indicate that Amazon's a platform, and the platform needs to scale. This is the business model of Amazon, and this is not going to be a lecture in business. It's just going to lead into why Amazon needs to scale and what kind of scalability Amazon needs and how that progresses. Okay, so this is the original Amazon business model, or maybe every business model. Starts off with, we want to have the largest selection in the world. That leads to a good customer experience. It drives more traffic. Brings sellers back, which means that you get more selection. And this becomes a sort of a flywheel. Because selection is one of the drivers why people actually come to your site to buy things. They get growth. Yeah? In Amazon, we've made the decision that if you have growth, you immediately translate that money back into lower prices. You get lower prices, which drives into the customer experience. So you have large collection, low prices, drives customer experience. And you get this flywheel going. This means that the site needs to be incrementally scalable because you continuously need to grow your system. Not just the business that grows, it's everything underneath that grows also. I think selection will always be important, but even more important will be low prices. It seems like kind of a mundane thing to talk about, but 10 years from now, low prices will still be important. You know, 10 years, it won't have changed. It won't go somewhere else because you don't care about money anymore. So this is a good business model. So that drives into the fact that a system like Amazon needs to have incremental scalability to make this work. Because you don't want to do massive upfront investments to fill up all your data centers with millions of nodes for something that may come down the path. But all your systems, and whether they have to deal with increased request rates, larger data sets, all these kind of things, all these different axes is one thing that needs to scale. You need to be able to scale them step by step if you want to do it cost effectively. Why did I do that? So what does just my definition of scalability. So what does scalability mean? Now let me go over to this. So that if you increase the resources in the system, yeah, you need to get improved performance in a manner proportional to the resources that you've added. This seems like a reasonable thing to expect. Yeah? That really is the definition of scalable. Yeah, and so whether you get more units of work, whether you get more, more requests done, or larger data sets. Yeah, larger data sets is also more performance. But then if you look at, there's another reason why you would want to add resources to a system. In general, you do that to get redundancy, to get better performance, or to get better availability. That means that if you add those resources to the system to get better availability, the performance should not suffer because of that. That's the definition in my eyes of a scalable system. Now, there's some more points. In reality, if you have to build a system, heterogeneity plays a very, very, very important role. Yeah, there is no way that you go and build a system today, and then you're going to run it, and that the next machines that you will add to it are likely to going to be of a completely different class. They'll have five times the CPU. They'll have more memory because everything was cheaper or faster or better. And so in reality, systems that grow are heterogeneous. And so if you've built a system that actually cannot adapt to the fact that these systems, the parts of the systems, will have different capacities, you will be losing a lot of your resources. So if you can't do that, you're not a scalable system. If you add systems, it needs to be, you know, I like to say you should have one operator per service, whether it has 100,000 nodes or whether it has one node. The software needs to be constructed in such a way that it's operational efficient. Yeah, that means, actually, that if some components fail, and they fail all the time, and we'll get into that later, that shouldn't have any impact on the operational side of things. These are all stuff, these are all things that you can solve in software. Yeah, and people are way more expensive and way more, let's say, way too intelligent to put them on these mundane tasks of operations. So these things are things that you should solve in software. Yeah, it's resilient because the larger you grow, the more perturbations you get. And it actually should become more efficient as it grows. It should not be linear, it should be sublinear. The more nodes, the more capacity you add to a system, you should grow more efficient. My definition of scalability doesn't work for everyone, but you know, it's what we use. So our challenges are, you know, so how do you manage millions of systems? How do you spread them all over the world? How do you keep this up and running all the time? And how can you figure out, you know, what runs where? And especially if you are, let's say, if your systems run in what we call at Amazon a controlled chaos. Yeah, if you really are an agile company, you want to run systems very fast, you'll have to reduce structure, and we'll get into that, why that's the case. So if you need software like Amazon, can you just go out and buy it? Well, we did that for a long time, actually. But slowly and surely, all external software is disappearing, because actually none of this software functions at the scale of Amazon. Yeah, and so we have to replace that with internal technology. There's few open source technologies we use, but mainly in settings where we develop the framework around it to manage the scalability and reliability of it. But of the commercial products, I believe only our database vendor is the only other commercial software that we're still using at this time. There's no other commercial software that we use. And why? Because at the scale of Amazon, it's very hard for vendors to test and operate their environment. So we continuously run. If I look back at, let's say, the site outages that Amazon has had, maybe one of the best examples is when I just joined in 2004. We hit, just because of Amazon's size, behind a load balancer, because the number of machines we had behind load balancers, we hit a bug in the load balancer that no other customer had ever hit before. And why? Because we had automated the management of that load balancer. Normally, you go to a load balancer, there's a command line interface, you add node to it. Now, if you have thousands of machines behind that load balancer, you want to automate that kind of thing. Actually, you want to integrate that with your deployment system. So software gets deployed, the node gets deployed, automatically gets added to the load balancer. We're really good in automating. Now, it turns out that nobody else with this vendor had ever automated that part. So, and given that it's so tedious to add thousands of nodes behind this one virtual IP address, nobody had ever added thousands of nodes. So we do that immediately, and let's say, without mentioning the vendor and making them look stupid, what this was you have this sort of a least connection spreading algorithm throughout the load balancer, where basically looking at the number of connections that are open to that node will actually decide which one is the likely loadest, and it will send a new connection there. The bug in the algorithm was that it kept this in a linear list. So it will run through the whole list on each connection to find out which is the likely loadest. Now, that's fine if you only have 5 nodes behind it. If you have 1,000 nodes, and your load goes up like Amazon, then immediately your CPU and your load balancer will spike, thing breaks down. That was probably the last quarter we used hardware load balancers. Yeah, and it's not because the vendor is stupid. This may be a bit of a mistake, but it's just that at this particular scale, software, no hardware, can never be tested. It's not something that you can expect of the vendor. At Amazon, we need to be aware that you use software really in settings that you can control it, just like anybody else is actually using that software. You shouldn't try to push it further. Okay, as I said before, lots of different patterns of software within Amazon. Many different technologies, either homegrown or borrowed from the open source community. Quite a bit of material, it's a basic new development done at Amazon, new algorithms developed, new techniques developed, not just copied from the outside world. Some other people would call it research, we just call it development. And we're fortunate to have this S3 EC2 web scale computing infrastructure laying underneath there that we can build out of. Yep. Now, for us, if we look at, we often look at research results. We read almost every possible publication that there is, because in the hope that research will be addressing a number of the problems that Amazon is, or let's say, we don't call them problems, they're challenges. Yeah, the challenges that Amazon is facing with. And hoping that some of that research will make it into production soon. Coming back to the previous slide, would we like to buy the software? Absolutely. Well, there's tons of very Amazon-specific things that I would like to invest my resources into. I don't want to build infrastructure. If somebody else can give that to me at reasonable cost, I'll do that. and we'll go off, do better personalization algorithms or do cool video stuff or whatever. Now, there's lots of differentiation to be made outside of the infrastructure piece. This is, Richard Gabriel wrote a great paper, an analysis on how software gets adopted through the years. Yeah, and so if stuff comes out of the lab, before it really makes it into mainstream production, is 15 to 20, sometimes 25 years. That means that the stuff that the guys are talking about next door, the virtual machine stuff, yeah, maybe that's, again, that's old technology. Maybe that doesn't count. Some of the other really new discoveries that are being done now, yeah, how to do peer-to-peer storage systems. Yeah, it takes quite a while before they actually, before you see them show up as products that are really scalable. Now, you may say, there's lots of examples to actually back up this story. Spreadsheets is one of the most easy ones. Founded by IBM in 65. You know, the real first commercial applications came on the market in 86. And whether you look at windowing systems or you know, many other technologies that are common today, it took about 20 years before they came out of the lab and actually into the hands of people. Yeah. And of course you're going to say, no, not the web. The web is faster, really fast. No. All the technologies that underlay the web have been developed in the 1960s. Yeah, it wasn't that someone put them together into a big usable piece, public piece, that we all came to become familiar with them. But they are old technologies, very old technologies in sense. Yeah, so it takes about 20 years. It's obvious that for some companies who are faced with huge scalability challenges, you can't wait 20 years for someone to take research and bring it into production such that you, a well-tested production, such that you can actually use it. As a sidetrack, there is a great interview in this month's ACMQ magazine. Margot Seltzer has a conversation with Mike Stonebreaker, and I'm not saying that Mike touches on this, but he shows how the current database companies are basically dinosaurs. You know, they still run technology that has been developed in the 1980s. And all the different things that we see around us, with using data stores and data streaming and key value pairs and all of these kind of things, yeah, they're just ignoring. They're still doing databases the way that they used to be doing databases for a very long time. And so there's lots of opportunities, actually, for people to take research and do something useful with it in production. Great article to read. So for us, this adoption cycle is just way too slow. There's things that we have to deal with now that actually sometimes already come out of research, sometimes things that, you know, we do collaboration with research teams, just to get accelerated access to research, to the research results and try to figure out how we can implement those. Now, actually adopting research to build products on is almost impossible. Now, if you're a developer and you're not trained in understanding, you know, why Andy doesn't like Mendel, yeah, you'll have no idea why you should be using a virtual machine or a microkernel. Yeah, it's very hard, you know. So if you only read the research results, you know, you'll see that researchers don't agree with each other. The everlasting battle between threads and events. If people would read all those papers, if you would ask a developer to read all those papers, in the end, would he be able to make a decision whether he needs to go with threads or with events? Or maybe a combination of the two? No, he will be thoroughly confused. So how can we expect people to take research results if, you know, the research community can't even get, I won't say their act together, because that's not, that's maybe an unfair criticism. It's not the research community's task to prepare things for production. But If you're a company that requires this research, it's pretty hard. And what you often see is then that developers will pick up one of the technologies because they like it for some reason. And we'll drill later on into what particular research results they pick and why they actually pick it. It doesn't necessarily have to do with that it's on top of the list, but there's another reason why they actually would select a particular technology. So researchers don't agree, there are too many possibilities, and the assumptions around much of the research is often very unrealistic, which makes it, even if you would want to adopt the technology, pretty hard to do. Yeah, and so a large part of the rest of the talk, I'll be talking about, the impact of assumptions. Yeah, this is a data center. Actually, it's not a data center that is whole anymore. What's the importance of this? The importance of this is that if you think that failures are not correlated, you're wrong. Yeah? A small tornado in Florida will knock out permanently a large piece of your data center, and many of your nodes will fail when this happens. Yeah? And so let me give you another example. Imagine you put a number of data centers close together. That's great. You can have high throughput, low latency, communication between them. Really good plan. And then you happen to have put it in a place where actually heat wave happens. You didn't think about this one. Yeah? Okay, so heat wave happens. No problem. You've got all these contracts with everybody to provide you enough cooling and stuff like that. And then it happens that this happened to be in an area where there's also lots of government and a big city. That means everybody flips on their air conditioning. At that moment, the power company comes to you and says, I'm not going to give you power anymore. Go to your generators. Fine. Yeah, that's where you got the generators for you. Fire up the generators, produce your own power. Everything is still humming along in all of your data centers. Then it turns out that data centers need fuel. Or generators need fuel. So at one moment, you become dependent on actually the oil companies producing fuel. Now, had you really thought about that part when you started constructing everything, getting guarantees on who gets the fuel? This story is actually from a company that had these data centers in Virginia. So they had guarantees on delivering the fuel. Unfortunately, in Virginia, the government has also all of their data centers, who are also all running on gas at this moment, on diesel. And it turns out that at that moment, the oil companies decided to only deliver to the government and not to you anymore. So even if you've built perfect software, yeah, and you have multiple data centers, there can be all sorts of external reasons why sometimes you just have to shut down a data center for no reason. If your software can't deal with it, you're pretty much, can I say, screwed. Yeah. Of course, we know that other companies deal with this just as much as that Amazon or anybody else in the world. If you only have one data center and you have a power failure, then you have 110 million very unhappy customers. Yeah. And the thing is that they continue to pound your site so that, they all keep going down your front door. If you then haven't built a system that actually allows them in the front door very smoothly once you open up again, what happens is that, in this particular case, actually, they opened up the front door, 110 million come in, and you're down for the coming 2 hours again. So there's lots of things to be done around building really smart systems under all sorts of circumstances. This happens also. Yeah, things catch fire. Did you really have a disaster recovery mechanism online such that other pieces of your software actually can just continue to run? At Amazon, we have the strategy that we can lose one or more complete data centers without that it impacts the performance to the customer. So we measure SLAs rigorously, and we can lose complete data centers, and you, as a shopping customer, should not be impacted by that. And we And given that data center failures happen, we know that we can make good on that. Now, failures happen, and they're just not something that happens occasionally. Yeah? It happens all the time. So if you want to make some assumptions around failures, assume that it happens all the time. It's not something where you have to think about a recovery mechanism that happens somewhere later on. You know, you are recovering all the time in a large system. It also means that, so I don't know whether you guys went to Usenix Fast. There are a few great papers there about the reliability of hard disks. And if you look at that, there's whether your numbers match your numbers, it doesn't matter, but somewhere between 4 and 10% of your disks will fail per year. Now, that's fine. You know, those are assumptions that you can make. You can build against it. It does mean that if you run a large data store, for example, between 4 and 10% of your data is continuously being restored because you just lost the disk. So a restore operation or a recopy or a re-replication technique needs to be a continuous part of your operation. Yeah? And malicious participants all the time, whether they're really malicious or whether they're just stupid developers, you know, sometimes it's hard to distinguish between the two. Yeah? An unintended, you know, infinite loop hitting on your shopping cart. It'll take some time for you to figure out why there are 50,000 items in that shopping cart. Yeah? It also means that Amazon, you know, we often see things in the long tail. Assuming, building your system, as if there are only 5 items in that shopping cart is wrong. Yeah? No matter what extreme you can think of, at Amazon we can find an extreme back that you will have to take into account. Because often those extremes are your best customers. People may use a shopping cart, for example, to do institutionalized buying. Suddenly, 1,000 items in a shopping cart, no problem, needs to perform just as good as a shopping cart with 1 item in it, because those institutionalized buyers are really, really, really good customers. So, as I said before, everything fails. Every possible component in your computer, in your network, will fail. It's guaranteed. Yeah? And it's not only that it will fail just by itself, it will fail in different batches. Yeah? Racks will go down. If you have a switch per rack, the switch will go down and you won't find the rack back again. Data centers are made up out of areas. Suddenly the power to that area goes out. Data centers fail. We lose sometimes whole geography, or it looks like you lose whole geographies, or even continents. So an assumption, if you build your systems, that failures are not correlated, automatically almost disqualifies your research for adoption in practice, because failures are correlated. And then this idea that you can build systems that are fail-stop, yeah, or that systems are, that they fail by just stopping. Well, I have, indeed, if you know, your router explodes, yes. But in general, what happens is that one memory bank goes bad. Or let me give you another example. You have this system set up with RAID 5. One of the disks fails. Yeah? So the wonderful thing about RAID 5 is that it will just continue to function. However, the vendor didn't tell you it will function at 1/3 of the performance. Yeah? Because some of these controllers will just continue to hit the bad disk, and you'll get just a horrible throughput on that disk. So even though it hasn't failed, that node, suddenly a node that was running at, let's say, 90 TPS drops down to 50 TPS for no apparent reason, because the disks look fine, because it's one virtual disk. Memory looks fine. Everything looks fine. It just drops off the earth suddenly in terms of performance. So things do not fail by just stopping only. Now, this is going back to assumptions. Sometimes assumptions that you make are way more deadly than assumptions that we make in computer systems. It is maybe a bit of a coarse or an extreme one where you can make assumptions that, you know, impact your life. But we have many examples where technology decisions actually did impact people's lives. Yeah, the Titanic, as much as we like it as a cool romantic story, was actually a highly fault-tolerant ship. They could lose 6 of the 18 compartments and actually still function. In the particular failure scenario they went into, they lost 9 compartments. Yeah, because they had assumed that whatever can you hit that, you know, will cause us to lose more than 6 compartments. Deadly disaster. Yeah, the Estonia ferry disaster, another case where this is a really tragic one, where the constructor of the ferry needed, he had a CAT program, and he needed to build the door that actually latch, and the latch on the door, the lock on the door. He didn't have the lock from the supplier at that moment. So what he did is he looked at what were reasonable assumptions to make about that lock and put those assumptions into the CAT program. It turned out that the lock that eventually was delivered was much weaker. So this ferry in the middle of the sea, you know, runs into bad weather, stress on the lock increases, the whole front door, or whatever you call this loading dock of the ferry, goes down, and 200 people perish with it. Assumptions are very deadly. The others, probably you guys all know, Patriot missiles is the one to call out with. This is Patriot missiles in this case is during the first Iraq war. What happened there is that actually Patriot missiles were kind of outdated, and those Scud missiles were much faster than that these Patriots could do. But they what they did is they took 2 integer registers that they had and converted them into, with software, into a reel. And using that, they could actually try to track the speed of which the Scud could come by and they could hit it. Unfortunately, they hadn't, when they had done the testing on that, they had always done it just after the machine, after the computer was rebooted. So, you know, the register almost always started from 0 or from a very small number. If the computer had been running for 20 hours or more, a shift had happened in the registers. You couldn't get the position anymore. And a number of Scud missiles during the Iraq war just happily passed by Patriot systems, and Patriot systems completely misfiring. Yeah, just assumptions making about what fails and what cannot fail. Let's go to a less human-intensive one, the Denver baggage system, which is actually a reasonably good story to tell. Let me get some water, sorry. Any of you have been through Denver? Let me put it that. Any of you ever have picked up luggage in Denver? Have you ever figured out whether this came through one of those nice automatic carts that go underneath there? It's a nice airport, Denver. Now, Stapleton was the first airport before that. It was built somewhere in the 1920s. It was obviously hugely out of date. So they decided to build a completely new airport. And there were a few things around air travel that they really, really wanted to improve on, because the distances were huge at the airport, and they wanted to get to some things that we know really well: better latency, better throughput, and higher reliability. Yeah, and why did they want that? Is this: the goal was to keep airplanes on the ground shorter and shorter. And the biggest bottleneck they had until that moment was luggage that had to go from one plane to another plane. And so that dramatically needed to be cut down, and the throughput needed to go up. Yeah, so in the old system, it took about an hour to get it back from one airplane to another. Their goals were to cut that down to below 10 minutes. Yeah, and it was a lofty goal, but it had been done before. San Francisco, Frankfurt, Munich, all had these kind of automated baggage systems. So why can't we do it? Yeah. So they came up with something really spectacular called telecars. Yeah. They basically hold your luggage. But the real cool thing about the telecars is they never stop. Meaning that a car would come by, it would slow down a little bit to 4.5 miles an hour, a bag would be thrown into it, and it would speed up again. Yeah. The same for unloading. You know, it would not stop when it would unload. It would kind of throw it off. You know. Okay, you can already imagine where this talk is going after this, yeah? And it would be going throughout, underneath the Denver airport at 20 miles an hour. Great system. These are kind of the components necessary that they came up with to actually build the system with. Lots of fiber optic Ethernet. And these are, they're about 10,000 engines because they're linear induction. The cars didn't have any engines themselves. They were linear induction driven. So you've got all these 10,000 nodes throughout the system that have to drive these cars. And lots of conveyor belts and other things. 200 million, they expected to build it. Yeah, and so as you can imagine, what's really difficult is actually making sure that there is luggage that actually goes into this car. Yeah, that's the first challenge. Then you have to figure out, where does it need to go? Yeah, can you read it? Can we? What are all the challenges around there? Is that initially they thought that all routes would always be up. It turned out they had to build in a complete detour system because cars would break down. You couldn't get through that route anymore. You suddenly had to reroute things through other parts of the airport to get your luggage there. As you can see, automation is not necessarily, I should say, an improvement always. Yeah. This is an image of how the system works now. These cars go still by at blinding speed. It's actually, if you ever have a chance, is there anybody from the University of Colorado? These guys give tours. It's worthwhile going. Yeah. Some people blamed the delay on politics. Yeah. But the real problem was that the project started much later. The project to build the baggage system started much later than they had started the design of the airport. And at the design of the airport, they had made some assumptions about how the baggage system would work. Yeah, and we'll get into that, why that was. So it is one of the biggest disasters around there. Yeah. Of course, they did a demo pretty soon. That didn't work that well. Yeah. Everything that could go wrong absolutely went wrong. And this had the world press present looking at it. Yeah. There's many crashes. Really, this is... So some of the things that, you know, they just didn't anticipate is that if one of those pieces of luggage falls off and it breaks open, you get all these clothes that come out of there. And you know, that will derail many, many cars to come. And there was many other integration problems that they had. Lots of other nasty assumptions that they had made. They had made the assumption that gate agents would be much slower than they actually work. It's one of the things that they probably observed. They probably traveled enough thinking about how slow gate agents are. And reality, it turns out, they're much faster. Yeah. And there's all these kind of things like scanners. So they had assumed that if you put a label on something, you can actually read it. Well, that turned out to be a disaster because, in general, you couldn't read those tags. And so cars would be going much too fast for the scanners to pick up the tags going by. If luggage would be too light, yeah, if you wouldn't have heavy luggage and the car would have to unload it, luggage would just flow off the car because it was just way too light. Lots of things. It was a disaster. Yeah. Additional trouble, and this probably anyone who has ever designed a real big system can really appreciate this one. So when they were building it, lots of power failures happen. That happens if you build big buildings. However, they had built these 10,000 little engines that need to keep the cars running with, how do you call them? They've got circuit breakers on them. So if a power failure happened, you had to send people out and push the power buttons on 10,000 of these induction engines. Yeah? And there's lots of queuing in the system that they didn't anticipate. You know, crossroads, sideways, all of these kind of things. Disaster. Yeah? Past, you know, there are many places where you would have want to have people sit there testing things, but then there were large parts of the areas underneath the airport where you couldn't get radio contact. So testing was impossible. Yeah? Now, the biggest problem around this, it was very ambitious. Yeah, and actually, this was a system, where you compare it to the Frankfurt and the Munich system, that was actually two or three generations ahead. And everybody thought that they could do this in software and kind of disregard the hardware piece of it. And one of the biggest problems they had was that actually the airport was not designed for their kind of baggage system. The assumptions that the original builders of the airport had made did not meet their expectations. One of the big things there is that the tunnels have sharp turns in them. There's no way that at 20 miles an hour you can make a sharp turn with any of these cars. Yeah, so all of these things, next to that, they were very cheap. They loaded up all of their components to the max. It's just one big disaster. Yeah, let's not do any more Denver. This is a list. IEEE Spectrum, I think, two or three years ago, had an article on why systems fail or why software projects fail. It's estimated that per year, industry and the government lose in the order of tens of billions of dollars on software projects that get canceled. The last official count of this is somewhere in 98-99, and that had nothing to do with the web and all the other things that are going on at that time. There were really serious enterprise integration projects. $80 million in software projects got canceled. Yeah? So there's lots of software that eventually do not meet expectations. So there's a long list that the IEEE gives. They do lots of research in it, figure out what are all the things that actually are going wrong when you build very large systems or when you build these systems. And the top three, actually, are, in my eyes, the most important ones. Yeah? Not knowing how to deal with immature technology. It hits you all the time. Yeah? Complexity and, you know, risks are two of the big drivers that will keep you awake at night if you have to build very large systems. Now, I want to focus a little bit on this notion of uncertainty. Yeah, because in reality, there's many risks that you don't anticipate. There's remember that the title of the talk is that life is not a state machine. A state machine assumes that all input is known, all transitions is known, and all output is known. Yeah? In real life, there is no such thing. Maybe if you're a very small system, you can achieve this by really managing all the environment. But if they go really big, or even moderately big, you have to deal with all sorts of events that you didn't anticipate. Now, often we say that, well, you know, we have to do all these assumptions because our software or our reasoning can't deal with uncertainty. It's just too difficult to do. And even if we would, we would have to introduce all this math and you know, engineers wouldn't be able to deal with that. I want to bring up the example of actually the guys from Control Theory, the one that do really big chemical plants and things like that. Many of the ideas and principles that the control theorists had originally were never adopted in plants. And the control theorist always said that's because there's too much math in there. Yeah? Actually, during the 60s, there was a change in how control theory was being researched, and they started taking uncertainty into account. And they actually started modeling uncertainty explicitly in their theories. That resulted indeed in math that was more complex. But as a result of that, because it was much more realistic modeling of the world, this more complex math was being picked up by all control theory engineers, and today is just a fundamental part of how people run these very large plants. Yeah, so in my eyes, there's a conservation law of uncertainty. That no matter what you do, you cannot get rid of it. Yeah, this you can try and encapsulate it, you can build software around it, but in the end, you only are moving the problem away if you do not deal with it explicitly. Yeah, and explicitly means dealing with probabilistic techniques, looking at events that might occur or that have certain probabilities to occur and how to deal with them. Yeah. In my eyes, the real winners can be to really make problems much smaller, decompose them in smaller things, and actually try to make those smaller pieces manageable. But if you just disregard uncertainty and move it away by making some unrealistic assumptions, your production system is likely to fail. Yeah. So this is basically it comes down to these points. Occam's razor then shows up. Yeah, because if people use assumptions, yeah, if they start introducing very constrained assumptions just to make the world work for them so they can build their research or their software, then the more of those assumptions you add, the more unrealistic the environment needs to be for the software to work in. So then if you have to pick a technology, yeah, technologies that are most likely to succeed are the ones that have the fewest assumptions made about them. So this is, if you're Jeff Chase this morning mentioned, 20 years of Usenix. If you've probably been here 20 years ago, you would have seen this particular debate. Do you guys know what the MIT versus New Jersey controversy was? That's one over there. Oh, great. So this is new for some of you. Yeah? MIT was considered, so this stems out of the early days of Unix. MIT was doing research and was doing really, really principled research. And those are four principles if you use research. You know? Simplicity, correctness, consistency, and completeness. Actually, in reality, so they considered simplicity to be the least important of these properties. And they made a few statements. The red ones are the ones that you really should care about. Completeness is important over anything else. Incorrectness is absolutely not allowed. So then we hit the New Jersey approach, Bell Labs, and the other guys that were doing Unix research in those days. Yeah? This approach is better known as worse is better. In some other companies, I know that this is considered to how to make your product actually ship. So simplicity in the New Jersey case is more important than anything else. You know what? It can even, if it means that you can build a system that is simpler, but that is slightly incorrect, that's fine. Yeah? You can sacrifice consistency if you would want to. And you certainly can be sacrifice completeness. Yeah? Completeness is kind of the holy grail if you take a more theoretical approach to building systems. Now, what was the result of that? If you have to build systems using the right thing approach, I can summarize that in it never gets finished. Yeah? Building things with the right approach has so many difficult and large and complex steps around it. If you ever have to build these systems for real life, you cannot control all the different events that will come at you, and your perfect state machine will never work. You will never get your system to work. And any of you who are in production, this last line, actually, that the last 20% takes 80% of the effort, one of those famous 80-20 rules, we all know this. Actually, the last 1% will take 99% of the effort, if you really would see the whole thing through till the end. Because it becomes increasingly hard to just beat real life into something that becomes predictable. So it takes a long time to get out, and it will only, if it will ever run, it will only run in very constrained environments. Yeah, so actually, worse is better has a number of very important properties. Namely, that you start off with building small things that seem to be usable, but not necessarily complete and correct. Especially in these days of open source software, we see that people might put out initial software that does a very useful thing, but doesn't always do it right and has some errors, but that doesn't prevent people from actually using the software. And then, most importantly, start iterating on the software, making it better. Actually making it better to the point that it almost becomes as good as if you would have built the thing with the right thing approach. Yeah? So if you build things using the right life approach, the right thing approach, yeah, you're likely to be doomed. Now, the thing is that, you know, most research actually deals with the right thing approach. There's very, very little research out there that actually actively promotes that you could do half-baked results as long as they seem to do something useful. Yeah? Actually, in research, it's very often allowed to sacrifice usefulness for doing it right. Now, it's very difficult to actually... why did I put this slide here? Well, let's go on. Okay. Majority of the research is doing the right thing. Only the strict assumption you get hit. This, one of those things is the discussion around frameworks versus tools. If you've ever taken two different pieces of software and have to make them work together, it almost becomes impossible, especially if those tools are, or if those pieces of software are what's called frameworks. That means that the framework, decides how you have to build your system. Now, it's hardly ever that a framework offers you everything that you need. So you always need to get something else in there. Two frameworks together don't work well. Yeah? Do you build it with this? If you're very unlucky, one has an event model and the other has a threading model, and you'll be fighting each other forever. Yeah? So frameworks, and we recently built a storage system that relies on, what is it, consistent hashing, peer-to-peer, it's a ring using rings, versioning using vector clocks, all of these kind of things putting together. Actually, picking one technology, you can kind of get your head around it. You bringing all of these technologies together makes things very complex. Yeah, and nobody ever, especially if you build things as a framework, you basically exclude lots of other technologies for people to use. If you build them as small tools that can be reused, you actually have a large chance of success that this technology actually gets adopted in real life. So coming back to developers. Yeah, remember, at the beginning I mentioned that it's very hard for developers to pick the right tool, or to pick the right research result. Because researchers don't seem to agree with each other, and you know, so they will look for simple tools that just work. Yeah, and let me get back to that. So that basically means that, remember Occam's razor, if they have to pick a tool, if they look at research and have to select from 4 or 5 different pieces of research, they won't necessarily look for the one which has the best performance or the best throughput or things like that. They will look for that research that makes the least assumptions. Because if a system makes very few assumptions about an environment, the chance that you can actually make it work in a real production environment is higher. Let's put it like that. So the environment in which you build very large systems actually becomes important also. Turing came up with these 3 different models, organized, unorganized, and the self-organizing ones. I like to believe that we, and I mean we as in general, we deploy organized systems. The one where we believe we can predict everything, all input, output, deployments of systems, load, all of these kind of things, we can predict them. There's a large business around that. You know, really, for example, scoping out how big your data center should be, how many nodes should be in there. There's a lot of people making a living on actually predicting this. We at Amazon, and I believe other companies also, have quite some time ago already hit the limits of what is possible with an organized system. And so our move is not to go to unorganized systems. You know, the AI stuff is just, no, we're not going there. But self-organizing definitely is a direction that we're taking at Amazon. Now, especially because organized systems rely on control. Yeah? The fact that you can exactly predict what's going to happen. You know, that all of these nodes are under your control, that nobody deployed some sort of service within your data center that you haven't heard of before. That means you have to have this whole social and company structure around it to avoid that anything happens in that environment that you didn't want to happen. Yeah? And so if you really want to control real life, yeah, you can only do it by building systems out of tricks, making it look like this whole world is deterministic. And it's obvious that if you build systems that are consist of tricks, yeah, tricks basically give you an illusion of control. They don't give you real control. Yeah? Life is not a state machine. And that's that, everybody intuitively knows that. Yet we often are building software and building organizations in very large scale systems that pretend as if we can keep this control. So life is probabilistic in essence. So that's what you have to keep in mind when you build this very large system. So, hey, I've got a cool picture. Let go of control. This is important. You have to trust that if systems grow very large, a number of the chaos theory principles set in. Now, if you look at Amazon at the detailed level, where we have these thousands of services, yeah, millions of servers, thousands of services running on top of those. If you look at the detailed level, you can almost not figure out what's going on in the system. Yeah? You need to go 1 or 2 dimensions up to actually get a good view of what the overall system is doing. Yeah? We actually have one metric. We've tried to develop tens of metrics over time. And it all comes down to actually having one. In the end, it turns out that at 2 levels up in dimension, there's one metric that really defines the health of the overall system. And that's actually the number of orders per minute, per second. So if failures happen in the system and your orders are not in, we can perfectly predict our order rate. Let's start off with that. So if you know, there's no perturbation in the order rate and failures happen throughout the system, you can almost say that the server, that system is perfectly functioning, even though things are failing all over the place. Yeah? So if you take the chaos approach, and you can introduce, you allow that your system has so much slack and so much probabilistic guarantees that You can add new services to it. They can interact with other services or push them to the max or whatever they're doing underneath there at the lowest level. As long as at a higher level your metrics remain stable, then you're fine. There's two books I would like you to recommend to you. Steve Grant, he is the inventor of a game called Creatures. This is an AI environment, and Steve actually wrote a book about how his customers used the AI tools in his system to allow life to spin up and to grow really big, and how all of these different components interact with each other, and how you can get stable, very large-scale stable systems using these self-organizing techniques. Another paper for you to read is The Limits of the Alpha Male. Now, that probably hurts quite a few people in this room, but there are limits to alpha males. And actually, if you read the paper, it has lots of impact in how you build systems also. You know, there are just certain scales, certain environments, where just having one leader doesn't give you the best result. Self-organizing, and actually, I think these are leopards, isn't that? Do you guys know about these stripes and stars and things like that? They actually, cheetahs? Oh, so all of them, most of these actually, sorry, never been there. I should go to the zoo probably more often if I make these examples. They hunt impacts, and they actually do not have leaders while they are hunting. They seem to do pretty fine. And it's not like they have a meeting before they actually go out and do things. They don't seem to communicate that terribly well among each other while they are hunting. Yet they have perfect, you know, synchronicity among them. There's tons of other examples that are actually in that paper that demonstrate of very large-scale systems that work very well without centralized control. Self-organizing, now if you guys have done any control theory, I suggest you read up on that one. If you want to build really large-scale systems, these will become your tools of the trade. How much time do I have? 10, 15 minutes? I could stop here. I won't like to continue a little bit more on the uncertainty track, and then I'm over. I won't do any Amazon promotion or anything. Don't worry about that. There's another paper. So I've given you three papers to read until now, or two books and one paper. This is another paper to read. It's by John Hagel and John C.D. Brown. They do this kind of management consulting kind of thing. They wrote a very interesting paper in which they review a number of trends they see in very large-scale manufacturing, or actually just manufacturing and business in general. Given that in that research they deal with uncertainty a lot, I would like to highlight a few things of their work. Especially because at Amazon we do use quite a bit of their ideas around how we build web-scale computing facilities. And the reasons why we went into this web-scale computing, in case you don't know what web-scale computing is, we sell storage and compute cycles and message queuing and things like that on a per-use basis. So they say that the past, as they've seen, there's resource management, how resources are managed, are using mainly a push model. Yeah, and we've seen that. Those are quite a few of the examples that I gave also. Yeah? It's where you exactly know what your demand is going to be, so you can start planning. You go into this cycle of development. You know how many participants there are going to be. And this is all about prediction and engineering around prediction. In their mind, or in their thesis, actually, they state that the world is moving to a pool model. Where resources, if you need them, first of all, are not controlled by yourself. Yeah? and the amount is uncertain. And so you'll have to pull these resources in whenever the amount increases. Yeah, and there's open participation, there's people-centric, loosely coupled, all these other goodies also. Now, the push model has this traditional cycle. You design something, you deploy it, you execute on it, you keep an eye on it, you monitor whether it's doing fine, and you collect lots of results, you go back to the drawing board, you refine it, and you start the cycle all over again. And for any of you who've been in traditional software development, this is kind of how we do things, isn't it? Now, the pull model for businesses works different. And this is not just computer science. Now, this is not, as I said, this is not just the IT business. One of the examples Hagel and Brown use in their book is a Chinese company that actually manages, I think, something like 8,000 different small vendors of little components of, they're all around manufacturing of clothes. Yeah, so if you want a label, you contact with that guy. If you want to have a sleeve, then those guys will do that for you. If you want to have a brown, you do it like this. There's a company that actually sort of intermediates between an end product and the different companies that actually can build these for you. So a new model for how we are building systems is, you know, you go find the different components that you need to use. Yeah? You then connect those resources together. And if you look at how that often happens, once you have these resources pulled in, often the little company, the company that pulls these resources in to produce this, also does innovation on top of that. It never stops there. And there's many of these Web 2.0 and web services and things like that companies that do similar, have similar approaches. So they pull different resources in, they connect them together, they do some level of innovation on top of those basic resources, and then, you know, deliver a product on top of that. And then you get a reflection cycle, similar to the monitoring cycle that you saw in the original model. But reflection doesn't have to do with that you rebuild your own systems. Reflection often has to do with finding different resources or different providers of those resources for you. If you're not happy with company one, or actually you wanted to have a different style of label, you don't go back to that one company to ask them to make a different label. No, you go to a different company that might be specialized in producing different labels for you. So these are very different models in which you pull these resources together to build this product for you. Yeah, so there are a number of reasons why these new resource models come into effect. Yeah, the largest one is that demand more and more tends to become uncertain. You do not, where maybe 10 years ago you were a traditional IT company, you could perfectly predict how many sales you would have throughout a certain period of time. Yeah, and you could anticipate all of these kind of things. These days, especially with many, many smaller service providers, demand is becoming highly uncertain. Yeah, customers become way more demanding, you know, and they will want to pick and choose for which pieces will make their product. In an uncertain world, most important is that you need to be able to function in an uncertain world. You need to be able to acquire resources on demand. Yeah? And this is very important. Because if you would have to invest for some, you know, to have, for example, a data center full of a million of nodes just in case you get slashdotted, yeah, or you become hugely popular overnight, yeah, that's wasting a lot of money on things that, you know, you might not need. So acquiring resources on demand is very important. And then especially if you acquire them on demand, you only pay for what you get, for what you use. Yeah. So these are the principles behind the Amazon Web Scale services. Yeah, you get storage, you only pay for the storage that you use, and you pay for bandwidth on a monthly basis. You can get a virtual machine loaded up, especially how you want it. You get charged on a per hourly basis. Yeah? You have a cycle in your usage. If you need more machines during the day than during the night, you just release them, and you only get charged for what you use. Yeah? Many of the Web 2.0 companies, first thing what happens when they walk into a VC office is that they're asking, are you using Amazon Web Services? And if not, why not? Yeah, because before this, VCs would have to invest a lot of money to actually just give you the infrastructure in case you would become popular. Yeah? But it's more important to have an infrastructure behind this where whenever you become popular, you can pull those resources in whenever you need them. So when demand is no longer uncertain. So this is the, if any of you have ever run a very large shop, yeah, 70% of the work that you do goes into other things than building your competitive advantage. Yeah? It's not like you go to the shop and you can just pull in 1,000 servers. If you're on 1,000 servers, there's probably a delivery time of about 3 to 4 or 5 months. Yeah? If you ever try to deal with 4 or 5 different ISPs to get bandwidth into your system, it's incredible. Then try to convince them that 100 gig Ethernet standard is actually a good thing to do because, yes, you can push this kind of data through there. So 70% goes into just doing this kind of nonsense. Now, it's not nonsense. You have to be highly specialized for that. And if you're just starting a company, you have no skills in this area. Yeah, so resources in the pool model are, from my point of view, the things we do in web-scale computing, you know, where you used to have a huge fixed cost, you can turn it into variable cost, which is very important. You know, you get more customers, you actually start spending more on your IT infrastructure, you don't have to do this up front, pay as you go, and you can really focus on that, you know, reducing that 70% of doing nonsense work. Okay, actually perfectly timed. Remember what actually got to the slide. That's already quite a bit of an achievement. I think Amazon is a really cool place, and yes, we are hiring. See me afterwards. Transitioning research into technology is hard. Yeah, and I didn't make it seem like a doom message. It's doable. Yeah? As long as the systems that are being built actually make realistic assumptions. Yeah, and I know that sometimes you have to do research and make unrealistic assumptions because otherwise you can't get that one detail worked out. If you have any illusion that your research will ever impact production systems, you will have to take a very, very close look at the assumptions that you've made and make sure that there are as few assumptions as possible. Because the fewer assumptions, the higher the likelihood your technology actually gets it. This actually is Occam's razor. Yeah? For those of you who don't know Latin, yeah, entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity. Thank you.